Yes, we can.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so I will start, and if you have any questions, just write them on the Discord page or just speak, okay? No problem, you can interrupt me. And thanks again to Quentin for organizing these seminars. And so for giving me this opportunity to introduce and to speak a little bit about two-dimensional materials. Okay, so a brief introduction. Several years ago, in fact, I was a PhD student in Pisa, and my professor, my advisor, proposed me to study a new material, which is graphene. So graphene is a single monatomic layer of carbon atoms, as you probably know. And it was 2005. And the supervisor of my supervisor showed me this figure here, and told me, you know, I already calculated the advanced structure of graphene some years ago. So maybe you can guess the year. I will tell you, it's easier. It was 1967. So indeed, the first work on graphene dates back to almost 60 years before its fabrication. At that time, Philip Wallace was studying graphite, and in doing this, he considered the properties of a single layer of graphite. The name graphene was not yet introduced, and he obtained the notorious linear dispersion of the energy events at the corner of the hexagonal Brillouin zone. And it was 1947. Less than 10 years later, McClure discovered that Landau levels in graphene have a relativistic behavior, in the sense that their energy is proportional to the square root of the magnetic field and to the square root of their index n. So, in fact, many central properties of graphene had been known for decades, but they were just a side result, let's say, of the interest in bulk graphite. The reason is that graphene itself was not expected to exist. In fact, according to Peyers and Landau, strictly two-dimensional materials are unstable due to thermal fluctuations. But in reality, graphene is not strictly two-dimensional because it shows some corrugations, and of course, it has a limited size. And so, in 2004, Gay and Novoselov managed to isolate for the first time anatomically thin carbon film, yes, that is graphene. And this discovery, which earned them the Nobel Prize, was merely based on the use of a high-quality graphite and a simple Scotch tape. So here you have a video. I don't know if you can see or hear it. Otherwise, there is a link that you can follow, and it is also indicated in the slide that Quentin sent you. And here they show how to obtain graphite by just starting from high-quality bulk graphite. A small quantity is placed on a Scotch tape, and then, after folding and unfolding the Scotch tape several times, monolayer graphene is expected to be produced by exfoliation. Then this material is placed on a silicon oxide substrate, which is optically inspected, and this allows to distinguish, I mean, to isolate, to identify flakes of graphene, of multi-layer graphene and single-layer graphene. So you will see in a moment in the video that optically we can distinguish the thickness of the flakes. And this technique, which is very easy, was indeed and is still largely used in labs because it is cheap, and then also because the quality of the produced graphene is very high. So, okay, maybe you managed to watch the video, otherwise you can maybe watch it in a second time. Okay, but of course there are other techniques to exfoliate graphene and to obtain graphene. For example, by mechanical cleavage or by graphite oxidation and reduction to separate single graphene layers by shearing or sonication, for example. These techniques are useful for the fabrication of graphene inks, for example. The epitaxial growth techniques are more suitable for high quality and large sample graphene fabrication. Among them, we have chemical vapor deposition, CVD, which is the most promising for industrial production. Molecular beam epitaxy, which is suitable for fabricating heterostructures with different with layer, I mean with stacking of different 2D materials, and then we have thermal decomposition of silicon carbide, where graphene forms by the carbon atom migration on the surface. Okay, so in what follows, I will first illustrate the main properties of graphene. Then I will provide an overview of some other selected 2D materials, because there are many of them. And finally, I will show some applications. This first part is a little technical, and let's say it requires a knowledge of solid-state physics, which most of you should have, but otherwise, let's say, it might be a little difficult to follow. But it is necessary to have an idea of the origin of the many interesting properties of graphene. I will make a break at the end of this part in case you have questions. The other parts are more conversational, let's say, more general. Okay, so let us start with the properties of graphene. Graphene consists of a triangular lattice with translation vectors T1 and T2, where A is the carbon-carbon distance. And the unit cell contains two carbon atoms, which identify the sublattices A and B, which are separated by a vector delta. Okay. The reciprocal space is also a triangular lattice generated by the vectors G1 and G2 that obey this relation. And starting from the gamma point, which is at wave vector k equals 0, we can build the whole two-dimensional reciprocal space. The unit cell of the reciprocal lattice, that is the Brillouin zone, can be obtained by connecting the gamma point to the neighbor equivalent points, drawing the perpendicular lines in the middle of each segment, like this, and considering the inner region. We obtain the hexagonal Brillouin zone of graphene. The points at the corner, at the corners, are called K and K prime points, and only two of them are independent, because all the other can be reached by a translation vector G1 or G2, and are fast equivalent. The properties of graphene are determined by the valence electrons of carbon atoms, which have a configuration 2s2 2p2. We can redefine this set of orbitals by hybridizing the orbitals s, px and py to obtain sp2 orbitals, which are oriented in plane along the direction of the carbon-carbon bonds, and keeping the pz orbital perpendicular to the graphene plane. We can show that the sp2 orbitals form a strong in-plane sigma bonds, which determine the stability of graphene and its excellent mechanical properties, such as the stiffness, the strength, and the possibility to stretch it in principle up to 20%. The pz orbitals form delocalized pi bonds, which determine the electronic properties around the charge neutrality point. In the band structure of my supervisor that we saw at the beginning, we can identify the sigma bands in yellow and the pi bands in green, and see that the low energy structure around the charge neutrality point, which is here, is conveniently described by the pi bands. Therefore, if we are interested in the electronic structure at low energies around the charge neutrality point, we can describe graphene by a simple tight binding Hamiltonian, which considers a single pz orbital per carbon atom. So we describe graphene just in terms of a single orbital per carbon atom, and we do not consider the sp2 orbitals, which just determines the mechanical properties of graphene. Okay, so this part is a little technical. Let us analyze the Hamiltonian, the corresponding Hamiltonian description, a little more in detail. So, a cell of a lattice with two atoms is identified by the indices N1 and N2, which correspond to a position N1 T1 plus N2 T2 in the lattice. Okay? We have just one pz orbital per carbon atom, so we can identify the state on carbon on the A atom, a position N1 and N2, with the orbital pz at position N1 T1 plus N2 T2. And the same for the pz orbitals corresponding to the atom B. So the position is in the same cell, is just shifted by delta, which is this vector here. So if we limit the coupling to first neighbor atoms, the pz orbital in the A atom is coupled to the pz orbitals of the B atoms inside the cell, and of the two neighbor cells here and here, with indices N1 minus 1 and 2 and N1 and 2 minus 1. So this is the effect of the Hamiltonian on this state. So we see that the pz orbital in A is coupled to the pz orbitals in the neighbor B atoms, and T is the coupling parameter, which is about 2.7 electron volts. Same story for the orbital on the B atom, which are connected, which are coupled to the orbitals on the neighbors A atoms. Okay, I don't go too much in detail, but just to give an idea. So, since the system is periodic, as you know, we have advanced structure, so we can introduce block states, which depend on the wave vector K in the first Brillouin zone. We have a block state for the A sublattice, and a block state for a B sublattice. And a generic state is the combination at given K with of these two states with prefactors psi A and psi B. Okay, so if we apply the Hamiltonian operator to these two states, we see that, for example, the block state A is sent into the block state B with this prefactor here, which depend on K, on the wave vector. And the same, a block state corresponding to sublattice B is sent to the block state corresponding to sublattice A. So, just to keep it short, we obtain a K-dependent Hamiltonian, which is a 2x2 matrix, where we have here this F function of a K, wave vector K, that is given by this expression. So, to obtain the band structure and the eigenvalues, we have to diagonalize this Hamiltonian, HK. By doing this, we obtain the energy bands E as a function of K, and the wave the corresponding states in terms of coefficients psi A and psi B. So, I just show you the result, which is here. So, if we diagonalize this matrix, we obtain this formula for the eigenvalues, which correspond exactly to this band structure that you can see here on the right. And we also obtain the eigenstate, you can see here, and so we obtain B sublattice at given K in the hexagonal Brillouin zone. And as expected, we see that the weight is the same on both sublattices. They only differ by a phase factor. So, there are some important points that we can, some important observations that we can make. So, the first one is that the eigenvalues, the eigenvectors, as we saw, have two components, A and B. This is somehow analogous to the case of spin up and spin down for electrons. That is why this is often called pseudo-spin degree of freedom. The second point, which is very important for applications, is that there is no band gap. So we have a so-called semi-metal with a linear energy dispersion around K and K prime points. So here the dispersion is linear and not parabolic as in standards and semiconductors, for example. And then, since the charge neutrality point is close, is here at AE equals zero, we have that indeed the low energy physics of graphene can be described by considering wave vectors close to the K and K prime points at the corners of the Brillouin zone. So, if we do this, for example, by selecting a point in the Brillouin zone which is close to the K point, we can write this wave vector in terms of the position of point K and of a small displacement vector Q, if Q is small, we can approximate the F function that appeared in the Hamiltonian in terms of the linear Taylor term of the expansion. And in the end, what we obtain is that the Hamiltonian, so the matrix to diagonalize to obtain the band structure close to the k-point as a function of this displacement vector Q, has exactly this form, where sigma is a vector of the Pauli matrices. Okay, the Pauli matrices that operate on the sublattice index A and B. So, this is very interesting because this equation corresponds exactly to the two-dimensional Dirac equation for relativistic particles. So, this is of course just a formal analogy. They have nothing to do in electrons in graphene, and relativistic particles has very little to do. The one with the other, but in fact, you can see that the equation is exactly the same once we substitute the spin degree of freedom that we have in the Dirac equation with the pseudo spin degree of freedom. We change the I was discussing about the analogy with the Dirac equation. So formally, we have that the Hamiltonian at low energy for graphene has exactly the same expression as the Dirac equation, which is for high energy relativistic particles. Once we substitute the spin with the pseudo spin, so instead of having the spin up and spin down for electrons, we have the sublattice degree of freedom for A and B sublattices. We change the light velocity with the subluminal velocity, Fermi velocity in graphene, and we set to zero the mass. So due to this formal equivalence between these two equations, we usually call the K and K prime point Dirac points, and the linear energy dispersion at these points is called Dirac cones. Okay, so what is important is that these properties of graphene lead to important consequences, and in particular the high group velocity and the linear dispersion in graphene entails a high charge mobility, which can be up to 25,000 centimeters square over volt per second when for exfoliated graphene over a substrate of silicon oxide. In suspended graphene is about 10 times larger, and for CVD graphene encapsulated in hexagonal boron nitride can be as large as 100,000 centimeters square over volt per second. So, let's say, this mobility is mainly limited by electron-phonon coupling. This mobility is much higher than in silicon, but is still much lower than in two-dimensional electron gases obtained in free five semiconductors heterostructures. Another consequence of a gapless linear dispersion is the wide frequency range for optical absorption in graphene. So now I don't have enough time, let's say, to go to show you the details of the calculation, but the main point is that by using the Fermi golden rule, we can conclude that the absorption coefficient is independent of the phonon frequency and it is equal to pi times the fine structural constant alpha, which corresponds to about to an absorption of about 2.3%. And this can be this property, let's say, allow us to optically identify, for example, the number of layers in graphene by simply measuring the light transmittance. Up to this point, we did not consider the effect of spin-orbit coupling. Spin-orbit coupling can be seen as the consequence of the fact that electrons have a spin, so they have a magnetic dipole, and when a magnetic dipole moves at high velocity, generates an electric dipole, which is coupled to an electric field, to the electric field, if the electric field, of course, is present. In the resulting Hamiltonian, we have the gradient of the electric potential, which is the electric field, cross the momentum P, which is proportional to the velocity, if you want, scalar product with the spin operator, which is proportional to the magnetic moment of the electrons. So, in the case the electric field is the one generated by the atom itself, we have a so-called intrinsic spin-orbit coupling with the dot product between the spin and the angular momentum, the orbital angular momentum. In the case the electric field is generated, for example, by an anisotropy of the crystal or by something else, we have a so-called Rashba spin-orbit coupling. So the intrinsic spin-orbit coupling couples pi, sigma, and higher energy bands in graphene. However, the resulting spin-orbit gap that is observed, but it is not observed indeed, is very small, is calculated to be around 20 microelectron volts. So, is very small. And this entails that the spin coherence length can be as large, I mean, can be larger than 10 micrometers at room temperature in graphene. And this is due, I mean, this small value of the spin-orbit coupling is due to the fact that carbon is a light element. So the electric field generated by the nucleus is small. Okay, we will see that this very long spin coherence length, in fact, is useful for applications in spintronics, for example. Okay, so I will make a very short break if you have questions on this part, which was quite technical. The next part will be less technical. But if you have any question, please just ask. I have a question. Can you still hear me or not? Okay, that's good. Okay, so I will go on, and then if you have any question or you can ask at the end or even after. Just contact me if you have any curiosity about these analogies between graphene and relativistic physics or spin-orbit coupling. Okay, so we move now to I will now give an overview of some of our two-dimensional materials beyond graphene. In fact, there is a huge number of predicted or fabricated 2D materials as X-ins, X-ins, 4-X-ins, transition metal decalcogenide, semi-metal decalcogenide, MX-in, and for example, hexagonal boron nitride. And another interesting point is that they can be combined, they can be stacked, thanks to the weak van der Waal forces between different layers. So we can obtain different materials by mixing them somehow. So let us start with XE, which consists of atoms of a single element arranged in a hexagonal lattice. So, in the same group of carbon, apart from graphene, we have silicin, germanin, stannin, then we can have phosphorine, arsenine, antimonin, or in group 13, porphyrin. Unlike graphene, these materials are not flat, but show a buckling due to the preferential sp3 hybridization. The buckling parameter delta plays a role in determining the gap in the band structure, the effective masses, and the Fermi velocity. The gap opening that we observe is due to spin orbit coupling, and it increases with increasing atomic number. So, for example, it is larger for stannin, where the gap can be as large as 100 milli electron volts. Another consequence of this buckling, so this delta parameter, is that the electronic properties can be tuned by an electric field. In fact, an out-of-plane electric determines a different potential on the atoms belonging to different planes. For example, here we can see how the gap in silicin and germanin is predicted to increase linearly with the electric field. In the case of phosphorine from group 14, we have a buckling instead of buckling, which means that atoms are arranged in a washboard configuration. The gap of phosphorine is direct, is rather large, and it increases in multi-layer configuration. Moreover, it can be tuned by due to this packed structure, we have a clear anisotropy along the zigzag and armchair directions of the lattice, which are indicated here in blue and red, which have significantly different effective masses from our example. So the effective mass is completely different in the two directions. And this property, together with a relatively high mobility, in charge mobility in these materials, makes phosphorine attractive for use in nanoelectronics, in particular field effect and tunnel field effect transistors. In group 13, we have borophin, which is, let's say, the new star of the moment. Borophin is polymorph. It comes in different phases with different properties. It has a very large and anisotropic Young modulus. It is predicted to be stretchable up to 15% and to show a large conductivity. And also it's interesting for the presence of Dirac cones, as for graphene, as in the case of graphene. It can be obtained by CVD, chemical vapor deposition on metallic substrate, from which it needs to be detached and transferred. Unfortunately, it is quite unstable and reactive, as is the case also for phosphorine, and therefore it needs to be stabilized somehow. A possibility is to use some cupping or hydrogenation, or in the case of hydrogenation of X-anes, we obtain the so-called X-anes. The most stable configuration are flat or chair geometries. And in the case of graphene, silicane, in this case, and germanane, the covalent bonding with hydrogen induces a large band gap. A different monolayer material, which this time is composed of two different species, is hexagonal boron nitride. It has exactly the same structure as graphene, but the two sublattices are no more equivalent. And this determines the opening of a large gap. Since the lattice parameter is very similar to that of graphene, it turns out to be an excellent insulating substrate for graphene, able to preserve and, in fact, enhance the high charge mobility of graphene. So, finally, we have the very large and popular class of transition metal decalcogenide. The chemical formula is MX2, where M is a transition metal and X is a chalcogen, as sulfur, selenium, etc. The physics of transition metal decalcogenides is determined by the partially filled d orbitals of the metal atom and the p orbitals of the chalcogen atom. Okay, these are the most common phases for the geometry of transition metal decalcogenides. We have a triangular prismatic 2H, which is usually semiconducting, while the distorted octahedral 1T and dimerized 1T, which is indicated by 1T prime, are usually conducting. The existence and the stability of these phases depends on the specific materials. So, in certain cases, the phases are metastable and can be controlled by an external electric field, or, for example, by strain. As we'll see, this has potential applications, for example, for memories. The transition metal decalcogenides with metal atoms from group 6, as molybdenum disulfide or tungsten diselenide, are usually in the 2H phase and are semiconducting, with a direct gap at the K prime point of the Brillouin zone. Compared to graphene, the presence of heavy atoms entails a strong spin-orbit coupling, which determines a significant spin splitting of the valence band at the K and K prime point. Indeed, such a splitting is made possible by a lack of inversion symmetry. In fact, due to time reversion. Due to time reversal symmetry, we have that an electron with given spin at given k vector has the same energy of an electron with opposite spin and opposite k vector. In the presence of spatial inversion symmetry, we have that the energy of an electron with given spin at given k vector k is equal to the energy of an electron with same spin and at with wave vector minus k. So if we combine these two, we have the so-called Cramer degeneracy that tells us that an electron with given spin at given k has the same energy that an electron with opposite spin at the same wave vector k. So there is a spin degeneracy. But in transition metadical cogenite, we do not have a spatial inversion symmetry, and so we observe a splitting of the bands, especially in the valence bands at the k point, in spin up, spin down at one edge of the Brillouin zone, and spin up, spin down, so with opposite spin polarization at the upper valley. So what is important is the large spin splitting that we observe for the valence band in these materials, and the fact that spin is coupled to valley. So we have a so-called spin valley locking, which is useful also for futuristic applications in valleytronics. Or, for example, it plays an important role in exciton, for exciton. The most investigated transition metal decal cogenide is molybdenum disulfide, MOS2. As for other materials of the family, its band structure changes when passing from monolayer to multilayer configuration. In particular, the gap decreases from around 2 eV to less than 1 electron volt in bulk. And also we observe here, for what I was telling before, the splitting of a valence band due to spin orbit coupling, which in this case is about 150 milliEV. Okay, so this was an overview, let's say, of the different materials beyond graphene, but there are many others, as you can imagine, many others. Now, I will quickly illustrate some of the possible applications of TUN-E materials, in particular in electronics, optoelectronics, and other things that as you will see, other fields. So let us start with electronics and with graphene. So graphene has the advantage of a high charge mobility and a monatomic thickness, which allows an efficient electrostatic control of the charge density. However, it does not have a band gap. Thus, it is not possible, for example, to completely switch off a transistor with graphene as channel material. For this reason, graphene is not suitable for application in logic devices, and it is more promising for high-frequency analog applications. Graphene-based radio frequency transistors show a decent cutoff and oscillation frequencies around 10 or 20 gigahertz. And this limit is more technological than fundamental, because physically is due to the quality of CVD graphene. On the contrary, transition metal decal cogenite, despite their lower mobility, do have a band gap. Moreover, they have self-passivated surface, which reduces interfacial effects and can be stacked in vertical heterostructure thanks to van der Waals forces. So this opens the door to applications in field effect transistors for logic electronics. Indeed, a complete integrated circuit based on molybdenum disulfide was demonstrated. So, in fact, it's something that can really find an application. However, the problems are that this technology is not at all competitive with the current silicon-based technology for high-performance electronics, and it is not much compatible with existing fabrication procedures developed by the industry. A maybe more promising application is in low-power electronics. As you know, an ideal transistor has a current that is zero for a gate voltage below the threshold voltage and jumps to its maximum value above the threshold voltage. In reality, a typical MOSFET has a cutoff, has an enough current which is different from zero at this zero voltage, and the current that gradually increases to, let's say, to the on current when we go beyond the supply voltage. So the point is that decreasing the off current and the supply voltage by increasing the subthreshold slope would reduce the power consumption of a transistor, which is important for applications which range, for example, from autonomous sensors to Internet of Things and this kind of things. However, the subthreshold slope in MOSFET is limited by the transmission of thermally excited electrons above the barrier. To go beyond this thermionic limit, it has been proposed to use tunnel field effect transistors, where the source and the drain contacts, usually P and N doped, are separated by a thin insulating layer and have a staggered band alignment. This means that at equilibrium, the chemical potential is close to the top of the valence band in the source and to the bottom of the valence band in the drain, and then when we applied a source drain bias like this, the current cannot pass because the conduction band in the drain is above the valence band in the source, and the thermionic current due to the tail of the Fermi Dirac distribution function is cut by the gap. So this allows us to significantly lower the off current. When a potential is applied to the gate, the bands in the drain shift, and finally a window for transmission opens, and the current rapidly increases with a steeper slope. So 2D materials are optimal candidates to implement tunnel field effect transistors, not only because of efficient electrostatic control and the low defect at the few defects at the surface, but also because they offer a large variety of gaps and band alignment. Here you can see the relative position of the bands in different materials, which can be combined by van der Waals stacking, for example. And here we have some demonstration of tunnel FET obtained by EMOS2 on germanium, or a completely two-dimensional tunnel FET. And both of them showed a sub-thermionic sub-threshold swing. Okay, in addition to low-power electronics, 2D materials are also suitable for printable electronics. Thanks to sonication, it's possible to obtain highly conductive graphene inks, which can be exploited to print flexible and extremely low-cost circuits on paper. Typical applications are antenna or radio frequency identification tags for goods tracking. This technology is already available in the market. Also, other two-dimensional materials can be transformed into inks, which can even be printed by inkjet printers. And the idea is to be able to print 2D heterostructures for a complete flexible and low-cost electronics, including diodes, transistors, etc. But for the moment, only the fabrication of capacitors have been demonstrated. Another emerging application of 2D materials is in non-volatile memories. You might know that several technology exist for memories. Flash memories, both of the USB keys, are based on the charging of a floating gate electrode. Then we have resistive memories based on the formation of conducting filaments in insulating medium. Sorry. I was checking. Yes. In insulating medium, so as you know, resistive memories, then we can have ferroelectric memories based on the polarization of the ferroelectrics, or based on the thermal induction of phase transition from insulator to conductor, so the phase change memories. So, 2D materials are useful for enhancing these technologies. For example, graphene can be used as conductive channel in ferroelectric memories, or as a thermal barrier to improve the heating in phase change memories, like in this case here. 2D materials can also be employed for new technologies, maybe hardly compatible with silicon technology, but suitable for flexible, low-cost, and printed electronics. For example, we have oxide-resistive memories, this one, which is based on the migration of oxygen atom under electric field. We can have resistive memories based on islands of conductive molybdenum tisulfide, which acts as trapping centers for charges in a graphene oxide film. Phase change memory, where the transition metal decalcogenides are predicted to change phase from conductive to insulating under doping, strain, or heating, as we saw also before, or all 2D tunneling memories, where graphene acts as a floating gate separated by insulating boron nitride from molybdenum disulfide. So, there are many, many possibilities indeed, still to be explored. As I was saying in the first part of the presentation, graphene has a very small spin-orbit coupling, which entails a very long spin coherence length, over 10 micrometers at room temperature. So this paves the way, let's say, for all graphene-based spintronics applications. The problem is how to manipulate spin, since spin-orbit coupling is so small. Well, it has been predicted and also experimentally demonstrate that proximity with transition metal decalcogenide, we have a large intrinsic spin-orbit coupling, can induce spin-orbit coupling in graphene. So this opens the possibility to manipulate spin in graphene. Also, it has been shown that the presence of an electric field in bilayer graphene entails a different relaxation time for in-plane and out-of-plane spin polarization. So, again, with possible application for spin filters. A much nearer at hand application in spintronics concern the use of 2D materials in magnetic tunnel junctions. In these devices, two ferromagnetic contacts are separated by an insulator. The electron transmission through the barrier is large for parallel polarization and low for anti-parallel polarization. This kind of technology is adopted in the, for example, in the head of hard drives, the one that we have on our PCs. And graphene can indeed be used as a coating metal to avoid the oxidation of the ferromagnetic electrodes and limit the effect of defects such as pinholes in the barrier. Also, it has been shown that materials such as boron nitride can be used directly as a barrier. So the hope is not only to improve the current technology, but also to scale it down to the limit, to the 2D limit, let's say, for a higher possibility of integration. Graphene is also optimal for sensing because of its high charge mobility and its thinness, which allows proximity between electrons and the charges on its surface. Then for its flexibility, and also quite importantly for its biocompatibility. Depending on the kind of sensors, for example for gases or ions, we have different technologies. For example, some companies as Nanomed also sell already on the market a graphene-based sensor for medical applications. So the idea is simple. So it's to functionalize graphene to specific biological molecules which reacts when coming into contact with a drug to detect, for example. When this happens, there is a charge transfer, which is like having a small gate on the surface, which modifies the graphene conductivity. Even more, graphene-based transistors have been shown to be able to detect the activity of a single ion neuron channel, a single ion channel in a neuron in vivo, with amazing perspective in the field, for example, of neurosciences. By the way, this study, which I did contributed to, is strictly related to Dominic's last week's seminar about interaction between molecules, cells, and electromagnetic field. Okay, still in health application, graphene has been considered in the fight against the coronavirus, too. In this short review paper, which is in press in Nano Today, the authors explore several possibilities of using graphene for fighting the coronavirus, such as functionalizing graphene to capture viruses and deliver antiviral drugs, or using graphene for protective coating or in biosensors, as we saw in the previous slide, or to fabricate masks. Indeed, the fabrication of masks is maybe the most promising idea, because a graphene foam can be deposited by laser induction on the masks, like this. And this kind of graphene is super hydrophobic, and thus it prevents infected droplets, let's say, to be absorbed by the mask. And moreover, thanks to the wide-spectrum light absorption of graphene that we saw before, this mask can reach the temperature of more than 80 Celsius degree under the sunlight. And so this allows a self-sterilization. Okay, we are going to close to the conclusion. Our applications can be in optoelectronics. The transparency of graphene, together with its high conductivity and flexibility, promote graphene as an electrode material for optoelectronics applications, in solar cells and LEDs. More interestingly, semiconducting 2D materials as transition metal decalcogenides can host excitons. With a high value of the bonding energy. Excitons are quasi-particles consisting in the coupling between an electron promoted to the conduction band and the hole left in the valence band, usually after photo-excitation. The weak electrostatic screening and the strong two-dimensional confinement give rise to very large binding energies, which can be as large as 0.5 eV. This means that excitons are observable at room temperature. The physics of excitons is very, very rich, and currently object, let's say, of very important studies, especially related to the multi-valley band structure of 2D materials and the possibility of creating interlayer excitons in van der Waals heterostructures. Applications of this kind of physics range from light emission to low-cost photovoltaic solar cells and photodetectors. To improve the performances of these devices, some technological advances are still necessary, such as the quality of large area van der Waals heterostructure and a low defect concentration, which is important indeed to limit the non-radiative recombination of excitons. Okay, graphene can also be used for metrology because, we just mentioned that graphene has a special distribution of Landau levels in the presence of a magnetic field. But what is most important is the separation between this Landau level in energy, which is much larger compared to what can be obtained in conventional two-dimensional electron assays. This means that the resistance standard based on graphene quantum Hall bars can be realized at low magnetic field, below 4 Tesla, and with large currents, and at a relatively high temperature, which is above 4 Kelvin. And indeed, the advantages in terms of portability and cost of this standard would be very, very significant. As was shown by our colleagues in the Laboratoire National de Métrologie in Paris. Okay, last slide, which finally I would like also to mention that the thanks to the mechanical properties of graphene and also the other 2D materials, we can find other interesting applications. For example, graphene powered by ions can be used for wearable strain sensors. And transition metal decalcogenides, in this case is molybdenum disulfide, can be used, for example, for piezoelectric energy generators. The stiffness of graphene can also be exploited for mechanical nanoresonators, which could be used as mass sensor. The predicted sensitivity is as small as 10 to the power minus 24 grams. So it's very, very small. And finally, the strength and the lightness of graphene can be used also to directly reinforce our structures. In these examples, tennis rackets or skis. Okay, and to conclude, I reported here this sentence. We should be very happy about the reinforcement of skis and tennis rackets because, according to this journalist, Hélène Pilochowski, she said that researchers in Grenoble just spend their time skiing and in tennis club, so we are happy that at least graphene can be useful for something. Okay, this is the end. Just to summarize, we saw that 2D material represents an amazing discovery in material science. They attracted much interest for fundamental physics and also for applications. Many 2D new 2D materials are still to be discovered or synthesized or exfoliated. Van der Waals coupling between different materials allows the engineering of vertical heterostructures with specific properties. There is a large variety of applications in different fields. And finally, the most critical issues for applications is the quality of a material. And so there is still a lot to do in this field. And with this, I conclude, and I thank you for your attention. So, if you have any question, please just ask. I was maybe a little long.